I got a letter a couple weeks ago from my alma mater, and it was reminding me that it has been 20 years since I graduated. And the class representative wrote, "I hope that you have that sheepskin diploma hanging proudly on your home or office wall." And I do not. It is still rolled up exactly like it was when it was handed to me back in 1995. Because back then, I had a lot more to think about than getting to the frame store. My parents were in bad shape, and they were getting worse. A couple months before graduation, my mom called me on the phone, and she said, "Megan, your father and I are really hoping we can make it to your graduation, but, you know, money's tight, and I haven't been feeling so good, and, well, honey, I'm just not sure that we can make it." And I interrupted her, and I said, "You know what, Mom? Don't worry about it. Forget it. In fact, I don't want you to come. I have been on this campus for 4 years, and it is completely inaccessible to someone handicapped like you. It is nothing but high curbs, stone steps, cobblestone pathways, and tiny antique bathrooms. You don't fit here. And besides, it's a 534-mile drive. You cannot handle being in a car that long in this much heat. And let's be honest, Dad's been out of work for a year, drinking all day, every day. Does he even have a license anymore after the DUIs? Like, I don't know how you're going to get here. And if you even got here, all I imagine is me having to help you around and Daddy making an ass of himself. Really, don't bother. Stay home. I think I'm just going to go home after exams and have him mail me my diploma. We'll go out to eat or something. Really, it's fine." And on the other end of the phone, my mom was silent for a little bit. And then she says, "Well, I didn't realize you felt that way. We'll be there." So I went to a college at a place called the University of the South, Sewanee. It was founded before the Civil War as a way to keep the sons of Southern aristocracy from going to some damn Yankee college. And then during the war, Union soldiers came through and blew it up. So then after the war, they rebuilt, and it's an Episcopal school, and they appealed to the Church of England and said, basically, if you give us a bunch of money, we'll build it to look like Oxford, which they did. So in East Tennessee on the Cumberland Plateau, rising out of 13,000 acres of forest land is this Gothic cathedral and Gothic buildings. And it's a place of deep traditions. It's not actually a mountain. The plateau is only about 1,000 feet high, but they call it the mountain. And they call the whole area the Domain. And they claim that it is the closest you can get to heaven. And when you come, you meet the angels. And you have an angel assigned to you when you go through the gates, and there's huge stone gates, and when you leave, you're supposed to touch the roof of your car to pick up a Sewanee angel to go with you. And it's got a lot of deep traditions, including the Order of the Gownsmen. So when you reach a certain GPA, you get to wear the long black gown. And basically, it's like Hogwarts plus bourbon. And it's got a lot of connections to Southern literature. So it's home to the oldest continuously published literary review. That's critical. Continuously published. We didn't stop for nothing. And it's got Tennessee Williams left his entire estate to Sewanee, and William Faulkner wrote about Sewanee in Sound and the Fury. One of the characters says, "And at Sewanee, they don't even teach you what water is." And this makes sense if you know that the Jack Daniel's distillery is in the next county over. Many of my friends minored in whiskey. And the whole place is built on drinking. So there's drinking societies. You go to the football games with solo cups of cocktails. You drink mint juleps on your professor's porch out of sterling silver tumblers. And considering that, my dad was a great fit for Sewanee. I mean, he was a shoo-in. But except for that, My family did not belong. I got to go on a full scholarship, and that was the only way I was going to go to college anywhere. But a lot of the students there were very wealthy, very, very elite. I went to college with classmates whose parents held key positions in the Clinton administration. I went to college with classmates whose parents were key Republicans trying to tear down the Clinton administration. Poli-sci classes were interesting. And basically, if you met someone and you recognized their last name, it's because it was an international brand. And then there were my parents. And my parents were most likely to be characters in a William Faulkner novel, not affluent supporters of a college that taught his work. So I had no desire to bring them there and usher their broken down bodies to witness the Tony receptions and tents and lawn parties that other parents were throwing but not inviting me to. And I felt pretty sure that I was safe. I felt pretty sure they're not going to make it, man. They don't make it to anything. My mother had multiple sclerosis, and she was diagnosed when I was born, and so couldn't walk and made it to very, very few of my show-off events as a child. And she would send my father to take pictures of me doing my little dance routine or playing Fur Elise or giving a speech on what makes America great. And sometimes my dad showed up. But oftentimes he showed up just in time for the standing ovation. Ah, beautiful! What was it again? Yeah, it's great. It's great. It's sweet, beautiful, sweetheart. And I had no illusions. I knew this was going to happen again. But then, a couple weeks after that first phone call, my mom called me, and she said, "Okay, Megan, I've got the plan. Your father is going to drive to Sewanee by way of Atlanta, which is the fastest way. The next day, your sister is going to take me and your 80-year-old grandmother to the airport, and I'm going to take two planes to get to Chattanooga, and then your father is going to get there and meet me just in time in Chattanooga, and then we're going to drive the other hour up the mountain to meet you in Sewanee. See, it's going to work out." And the idea was that my mother was in a cart, and that way then she could drive onto the plane, drive off the plane, be in air conditioning the whole time. It would make it a lot simpler with two planes and traveling and going around. And I said, I just don't see how this is going to work, Mommy. And she said, no, this is totally going to work. All I need you to do is find us a room. Can you do that? I could not do that. Sewanee's in the middle of nowhere. There's like one hotel and a bunch of vacation homes. And I said, Mom, parents reserved rooms for graduation when their kids were accepted to Sewanee. And I can't just, like, get you a Motel 6. It has to be handicapped accessible. You have special needs. You are asking the impossible. Seriously, if you guys come, all I can imagine is I'm going to be helping you. It will be no fun. We'll all be miserable. Would you please drop it? That's not how it's going to happen, Megan. I've talked to your father. And he said he's going to handle everything. So you don't have to do anything at all. All you have to do is get us a room. Can you do that? Can you just do that? Can you do that? Can you do that? I knew I couldn't do that. But I said to her, I'll try. And I pick up the phone, and I call the office that handles these kind of things, and I say, can you believe my parents? They think they're going to get a room, and it's got to be handicapped accessible. And they had a room. They had a room. It was at the convent. There was a convent a couple miles away. The Episcopal Sisters of St. Mary had a room, handicapped accessible, at a scream of a deal, just $85 a night, and they reserved it for my mother. And this was when I realized that God was on her side. And there would be no stopping this. And I made it through exams. Exams were a breeze compared to the dread I felt about the looming debacle of my parents coming. There was not a single trip that we tried to take when something didn't go wrong. And so when my father finally showed up without my mother in the car, looking pale and sweaty, beads across his upper lip here, eyes fluttering, Megan, sweetheart, I thought I'd save some money and skip the hotel in Chattanooga, but I'm going to need you to go pick up your mom at the airport. I thought, and so it begins. And so I drive the hour back to Chattanooga to pick her up at the airport, and this is before 9/11, so I get to stand at the gate. And I see her plane land in the distance so far away that the plane looks teeny tiny. And I watch as it comes taxiing towards the gate, and as it taxis towards the gate, it stays that teeny tiny. Until it comes up, and as it gets closer, I realize it's not even a jet. It's a twin propeller. is one of those little 25-passenger mountain hoppers, the kind that you're not going to get the jetway. They don't even get the stairs that drive up. It's the stairs that are integrated into the plane itself with little wire handles going down. I think, I have no clue how my mother's getting off this plane. And I watched 24 of the 25 passengers get off, and I think, did my mother even get on the plane? Is she still in Charlotte, just like eating a frozen yogurt or something? And then I see two burly baggage handlers go climbing on the plane, and they come out, kind of one's going backwards, one's forward, and they've got this big piece of cargo they're carrying overhead, and they duck down low so whatever this big baggage is can clear the top of the door without banging on it. And it's only once they've got this cargo halfway down the steps, arms trembling, that I realize the cargo is my mother, strapped into a teeny tiny rudimentary wheelchair, held over their heads, on her back, arms crossed, looking like a cross between Cleopatra and Hannibal Lecter. This is how she traveled. And I'm told you may meet your mother at baggage claim. Do you have a ticket to pick her up? And I get there, and we're waiting at the carousel for her cart to come out, and she's still like strapped into this little thing, and her arms are like this. And I say, "Hi, Mom." And she says, "There is no dignity for the disabled." And so I get her into the car, and we drive back up the mountain, all in silence. My grandmother's in the back seat looking out the window, and my mom's arms seem to still be frozen in this position, her lips tight. I think she's mad, but it's not until much later that I found out she developed a physical complication related to multiple sclerosis. So she was in pain the entire time, but she did not tell me. Because had she told me, I would have taken her straight to the hospital, and she would have missed the parties. She was not going to miss those parties. So she suffered through it. And I got to the convent to drop them off, fully expecting that I was going to need to get out her cart. I was going to need to help her out of the car, into the cart, help her into the convent, help her get dressed, help her get into the bed, help her get to the bathroom, as I always had to do. I thought, this is just it. I accept it. This is what I knew would happen. Go with it. Feel it. But as I'm starting to help my mom, across the beautifully manicured grounds of the convent comes a man who looks like my father, but is nothing that I recognize from recent years. His black hair is brushed and wavy. He's got aviator sunglasses on. He's got his cigarette and his pink button-down shirt tucked into his Bermuda shorts. "Hello, ladies. I see you made it. Don't you love it here?" And I could recognize that my father had reached what Tennessee Williams called the click. In Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, one of the characters talks about drinking enough until I get that click where my mind is at peace. And it's critical to know that the click is not the all-the-way loaded drunk, how I had seen my dad for years. No, this was just enough. And he said, "Oh, come on, honey, sweetheart, we're going to have a great time. All right, Megan, go your way." He had never told me that before. My father was a dump and run dad. "Get your mom. I'm out." And he's, no, I got it. I got it, honey. Go. We know where to find you." I didn't have confidence they would find me, but I wasn't going to lose my exit. And I blazed. So a few hours later, we had arranged to have dinner with my friend's parents. And her parents got divorced when she was very young and then remarried other people and had other kids. And so there was a lot of awkwardness there. But the beauty was that her awkwardness compared with my parents' awkwardness coming together kind of canceled each other out. And we were just entertaining. And we all gather at this little restaurant deep in the woods, big, huge pine trees and gorgeous leafy greens all around. And we had these three tables set up in a U-shape, and all the parents gathered together at the head of the table. And as my friend and I sat at the end, we looked, and it looked almost like the Last Supper with all of them lined up there. And then her father said, "Well, I have a surprise. Way back when my daughter was born, I bought some bottles of wine, 1973 vintage, and I've been saving them all these years for a special occasion, and I think my daughter's graduation is the time to drink them." And he motions to the waiter, and they come out with all these beautiful bottles of 22-year-old Cabernet. And I look at it, and I'm overcome with emotion because my mother bought bottles of wine in 1973 for that same thing, and my father drank them all by 1980. And yet, here we were at this beautiful occasion, and we still got to drink the 1973 wine. It was like everything was redeemed with a sip. And afterwards, my parents took themselves home, and I watched them go away, and I was free to go back to campus. And when I got back there, everybody had drinks in hand, walking around, saying goodbye. Everybody loved everybody. Everybody was going to miss you and you. And what's your name? Oh, I'm going to miss you so much. Oh, my God, I love you. Dude, we had such a special time. And I looked at all these people I knew, and we had been talking, of course, for a long time about what we do after graduation. And some friends were getting married, and some people had graduate school or internships or jobs or travel. And I graduated 11th in my class, summa cum laude, Phi Beta Kappa. And after college, I had my parents. I went away to school when I was 16. I went away to a public residential high school, and then every summer I worked at camps, I worked at jobs, I did everything I could to get out of the house. I competed, I performed, I auditioned, whatever I could to prove that I was better than the situation my family was sliding into. And then there I was, 22, on the brink of cashing it all in, and I couldn't. I tried to fill out applications, and it would say, why do you want to do this? And all I thought was, I don't. What I really want to do is be a part of my family again. As bad as my parents are, I still really want them in my life. And it's hard. It's hard to celebrate going home to a dysfunctional family because they don't write about that in the alumni magazine. And so the next day, I graduated in All Saints Chapel, which is a cathedral with soaring ceilings and big columns and antique pews and giant stained glass windows. And the only thing I can remember is the sound of my footsteps echoing on the stone floor as I walked down to get my diploma. But afterwards, my family was waiting for me in the courtyard, and we took pictures. And I had my black Hogwarts gown on. And my mom had on a white linen blazer, and my grandmother was wearing pearls, and my father had on a Tabasco tie. And he was standing there with a cup of black coffee and a cigarette, and he was looking up at the bell tower. Damn, Megan, you went to college in the 60s. I mean, this is exactly what it was like when I was at Carolina. I thought this was all gone. You sure were lucky to go here. And that afternoon, my dad got my mom back to the airport all by himself. And then he came back and he got me. And the two of us caravanned home the long way through the teeny tiny mountain roads that squirrel between North Carolina and Tennessee. And just after we got through the pass, we stopped for lunch and a beer. And I was still just full to bursting with having seen my parents make it. Because that whole time they were there, it was like something had been resurrected in them. They smiled, they laughed, they took care of themselves, they took care of each other. And I thought they turned their lights back on again. And I wanted to talk to my dad about that. Oh, Dad, you did it! But as he put down the glass and he looked at me, he was gone again. He looked like 10 years older. And there was no time for conversation, no desire for conversation. And when I got home, my mom was in bed. She'd had an MS attack, and she was trying a new experimental drug, and she didn't leave the bed for the rest of the summer. And I never saw my parents that happy, and especially not that happy together again. They got sicker, and they got poorer. And so now it's 20 years later, and my alma mater wants to know if I've got my diploma hanging on the wall. And the thing is, I don't need that diploma to remember college because my friends and I are still in touch. There's this thing called Facebook now. And we email and we write and we see each other over the summer and we have the same conversations and arguments that we've been having for decades. But my parents died 12 years ago. They're the ones I have hanging in frames on my wall. They're the ones I have to work really hard to remember, especially the good times. So I was pretty ashamed of my parents when I was in college. But at this point in time, on the brink of another big goodbye, I'm really grateful to them because they taught me that if you gotta go out, at least you can have one more great show. Thanks.